It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at the legal issues facing a plan to divert Great Lakes water for the Foxconn plant in Mount Pleasant. First, it's time for our weekly review of national news. The House Freedom Caucus is floating their own candidate for House Speaker. Mike Pompeo is getting set for confirmation hearings as Secretary of State after it was revealed that he met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and a bill to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller looks unlikely to reach a vote in the U.S. Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see out of the next Speaker of the House? What do you think of Mike Pompeo meeting with Kim Jong-un to talk about North Korea? How do you think he would handle that situation as Secretary of State? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Julie Grace Brufke is Capitol reporter at The Hill. Julie Grace, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about who might succeed Paul Ryan as the leader of Republicans in the U.S. House. This is something that probably won't happen yet. He's staying in the House for a while, but there's an open contention for who's going to replace him, right?
That there is. Well, he's endorsed House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who seems to be the front runner at the moment. But Kevin McCarthy right now doesn't have the conservative votes to get to the 218 he needs to secure the position. Steve Scalise, his name has also been floated. He's expressed interest in the position if Kevin McCarthy isn't able to secure the votes needed, which in 2015, after his comments in Benghazi, he wasn't able to do. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And then Jim Jordan has said that he's considering a bid, which, I mean, I don't see any path for Jim Jordan to get there. I feel like he hasn't been able to get votes for committee chairmanships in the past. He's kind of doesn't have the best relationship with leadership, but it could be a good way for the Freedom Caucus to get better committee positions or possibly someone from the caucus in some type of lower leadership role. So, yeah.
Talk about the House Freedom Caucus a little bit and their role in recent debates in the House.
Now, I mean, they've been, they were responsible, obviously, for largely part of why John Boehner left. And I mean, the omnibus, they were highly critical of the spending levels there and some of the riders that were on that. So I think that they're really looking, I mean, I've talked to a bunch of House Freedom Caucus members at this point about leadership races, and they haven't endorsed anyone yet, but they said they need somebody that's going to be able to push conservative principles forward. And right now they feel like they haven't seen that. My guess is they probably cut a deal with one of the, either Scalise or McCarthy. And, I know that they're trying to put together a list of demands of things that they'd like before they agree to give that voting block up there. But yeah, I mean, they've kind of been a thorn in leadership's side since they were created. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Now, this is April. Speaker Ryan is staying on the job until January and the new House takes over. Theoretically, he was going to stay House Speaker, but it sounds like there's some rumblings from Republicans in the House that, hey, maybe we should switch this now.
There are. I've talked to a handful of members on background. There haven't been a ton of people that have gone on the record about it that feel that the palace intrigue surrounding who's going to be his successor is distracting them getting things done, that it's going to be a problem with fundraising, that donors are going to want to know who's going to be leading the party, that they just kind of need a game plan in place ahead of midterms. And but for the most part, members that I've talked to have seemed relatively supportive of the speaker remaining in his role. But I mean, as weeks go on, we'll see. I think what fundraising numbers look like next time around, next time those are released, they'll probably have a lot to do with whether or not people are happy with how things are currently standing.
And one thing that Republicans may be worried about is that come January, they may not be electing a House Speaker. Depending on which polls you look at and who you talk to, they might be electing a House Minority Leader come 2019.
That is true. And a lot of the members that I've spoken to said that the person that they'd like to see is a speaker isn't necessarily the same person that they'd like to see as a minority leader, that there'd be different qualities that they'd like to see in either position. So I think that's going to be a huge factor in who ends up succeeding him there. But yeah, I Whether he ends up, I mean, if there ultimately are enough members that are pushing to oust him out of his current leadership role, I mean, they could have a speaker for a few months there. And then if they lose the majority, who knows if that person would be reelected or whether we'll see a whole new batch of leadership members.
Talking to Julie Grace Brufke, Capitol reporter at The Hill. It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Also on Capitol Hill, Julie, the Mike Pompeo confirmation effort, he's the nominee for Secretary of State, coming from that CIA director job. Before we get to that, though, it turns out he traveled to North Korea. It sounds like met with Kim Jong-un at the beginning of the month, trying to pave the way toward negotiations there. What do we know about that trip?
Now, I've been on the House side all day, so I don't have a ton of details on what actually happened on the trip there. But I know that a lot of Republicans that I've spoken to that are pushing for his confirmation feel that if he doesn't pass the confirmation process, that it'll kind of throw a wrench in the talks that President Trump's supposed to have with Kim Jong-un that's going to cause problems with Syria, foreign policy in general. So they're arguing that somebody needs to replace Rex Tillerson quickly so they can get that back on track.
I want to take a listen to Democratic Representative Adam Schiff of California. He was asked whether he thinks the meeting between Pompeo and Kim Jong-un was a positive step for U.S. diplomacy.
I think it is good news for diplomacy, and I'm glad that the meeting took place. Look, it's much better than the footing we were on before, where we had the President of the United States and the Supreme Leader comparing the size of our nuclear buttons. So this looks like preparations into a real talk between our president and the leader of North Korea.
So it could be some bipartisan support there for these diplomatic efforts, Julie.
Sorry, I had a hard time hearing you.
Sounds like there may be bipartisan support for this Trump White House effort to talk to Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, that's largely what I've heard. I think that most of the members I've spoken with feel it's a step in the right direction, that the diplomatic approach for any type of military approach and kind of trying to get things under control over there seems to be the general consensus among members.
And let's talk about the confirmation here. It sounds like Pompeo may not get approved by the committee he's before right now, the Foreign Affairs Committee, but it sounds likely that he'll end up getting voted through in the full Senate. I know you're on the House side, but what are you hearing over there?
Mm-hmm. Now, from what I've heard over there, it's not looking good for him in committee. But, Rand Paul is the only Republican that's come out against him at this point. Feels he's too hawkish, which is a lot of the Democrats' complaint as well. I think it's going to be a close vote. Jeff Flake said yesterday that he was on the fence, that he was waiting for some questions to be answered. And with McCain out, that definitely is an issue for Republicans. But I think ultimately he'll be able to get the votes, especially if Pence comes in to vote, to ultimately be confirmed.
We're talking to Julie Grace Brufke, Capitol reporter for The Hill, checking in on the week's top political news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the Senate in particular confirm Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State? Coming up, we're going to get into the Mueller probe. Congress, it looks like, is not going to pass a bill that protects Robert Mueller's job, protects him from being fired by the president. Should Congress do that? Should they not? Are you worried that Robert Mueller is at risk of being fired? And some Republicans are saying, hey, we should scale back some of the spending we passed earlier in this big omnibus package. Do you think that's a good idea, or should it stand as passed? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation with Julie Grace Brufke, Capitol reporter at The Hill. It's our weekly look at the latest political news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Looks like Congress is not going to pass a law to protect Robert Mueller from being fired by the president. What do you think of that decision? Should they pass a law like that? Do you think Mueller will be fired? Do you think he should be fired by the president, by the Department of Justice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's talk about that decision on Robert Mueller, Julie Grace. There was talk, some bipartisan legislation, it looked like, to protect his job. What's happened now?
So in the House side, Charlie Dent and Peter Welch, bipartisan bill that would have protected Mueller from being removed as special counsel had been introduced. Grassley on the Senate side had introduced something similar. But both sides of leadership, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, have both said they don't think it's necessary. They've received assurances from the White House that they don't think he's going to be fired, that the investigation will carry on. So it conservatives had called for him to be fired. They feel there's been they feel that there's been the case has been compromised, and yeah, it's it doesn't look like they're going to be able to take they're planning on taking up that bill.
And I want to move on, Julie. I want to move on to a piece that you wrote. Actually, the House, well, Congress as a whole, passed this big omnibus bill, taxes and spending, resulting, people are concerned, in big deficits. And as you wrote, some Republicans are saying, hey, let's go back into this now and cut some of that spending. What are we hearing?
So Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader, and President Donald Trump have been in talks about possibly trying to take up a rescissions package. So the White House would send over requests to claw back certain provisions of the omnibus, that had passed back in March. Now, I've heard mixed things. Critics feel that it's going to hinder Republicans' ability to negotiate deals in the future. Can't just kind of renege on a deal. He argues that they need to see what they're putting forward before they shoot it down. Mitch McConnell said at his press conference this week that that there's no way the Senate's taking it up. So it appears to be dead in the upper chamber. I think the White House, last I had spoken to sources over there, were planning in early May to send over the rescission. So, I mean, unless Mitch McConnell changes his mind, I think it's essentially dead in the House. But stranger things have happened. Maybe Mitch McConnell will have a change of heart on his plans over there.
Let's bring on a caller on this now. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I would say this changing the spending would be a big change from the way things are usually done, in that they already made agreements on this is what gets spent. But frankly, if they're going to do that, how about they help deal with the federal budget deficit by taking away the tax cut that they just put through that'll put a big hole in the federal budget?
Nate, thanks for the call, Nate. Julie, if they're unlikely to tackle the spending side of thing, it sounds like they probably wouldn't want to go back on those tax cuts at the same time.
Now, Democrats have made that argument, and I don't see the tax cuts going anywhere soon, unless Democrats take back the majority. Republicans are their main talking point during in the upcoming election is tax reform. So they argue that that's going to eventually pay for itself in economic growth, and it's really spending that needs to be controlled ultimately. So as long as it's Republican controlled Congress, I don't see any changes happening.
With the spending rescissions, you talked earlier about the Freedom Caucus further on the right of the Republican Party looking for compromises. Could the House maybe tackle these rescissions, even knowing it's not going to go to the Senate, just to throw a bone to a Freedom Caucus member saying, hey, we can at least have this symbolic vote to go back and cut that spending?
I mean, absolutely. I think that's a large part of why they're considering it. A talking point to kind of restore the image of fiscal responsibility in the party ahead of midterms. I also don't think that's going to hurt Kevin McCarthy's chances of getting on the Freedom Caucus's good side ahead of leadership elections. It's a symbolic gesture, kind of like the balanced budget amendment vote that they had a couple weeks back. It's definitely something they could use as a talking point going forward. is election season is upon us now.
And you had mentioned the kind of idea of Republicans maybe being worried about their brands and the higher deficits, the new deficit numbers we're seeing coming out. Is that something you hear House members talking about, a little buyer's remorse when these trillion-dollar deficits are projected?
And I haven't heard too many Republicans complain about the tax bill. Ultimately, I feel like they're pretty happy with how that's turned out, campaigning on it. I have heard a lot of grievances about the omnibus. Obviously, the president wasn't a big fan of the omnibus. He came out in a press conference after he signed it saying he wouldn't sign another bill like that going forward. I mean, Democrats definitely got a lot of wins in the omnibus, but I'm not sure without having a supermajority in the Senate that they could have gotten anything much better that would have been able to pass over there.
Nate, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. It's our weekly roundup of national politics. We have Julie Grace Brufke with us, Capitol reporter at The Hill. We're looking at some of the big stories. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Should Congress have protected Robert Mueller's job? Are you worried about him being fired? What do you think about this idea? Looks like it's probably not going to happen, of going back to that big spending compromise bill and cutting some of the spending in it. Call in at 800-642-1234. And what do you make of a growing list of Republicans announcing they're not running for re-election or even leaving the House now? And Julie Grace, I wanted to touch on one of those, Representative Dent, who you mentioned earlier. He had already said, hey, I'm not running again this year. He's a Republican. Now he's saying, I'm going to get out now, sooner. What do you make of that story, first of all?
Now, I had spoken with Charlie Dent right after he initially announced that he was going to retire a few months back. I know that he's grown frustrated with how the dysfunction in Washington and the partisanship. And he said that it wasn't necessarily the Trump administration that made him want to leave, that he'd been considering it for a long time. My guess is he's probably starting to entertain job offers and look for new opportunities. Had he run again, he would have had a difficult reelection with the way Pennsylvania just had their map redrawn. So I think ultimately he's just kind of over it
and
ready to get out.
And he's one of a fairly large group now of Republican House members, either getting out of politics for now, running for other office one way or the other. They're not coming back to the House. Is that something you hear a concern about from House Republicans?
It's definitely, I feel like, been a larger than average number of people that have announced retirements. And there's definitely a large number of committee chairmen that are leaving along with, I think it's something up 40 members that have announced that they're retiring. I think there's definitely some concern, especially certain districts like Brian Costello and Pat Meehan's former district in Pennsylvania. I think New Jersey is going to be a big problem with them. There's been Frelinghuysen seats. I mean, there's just been, if you look at Cook Political Report, there have been a lot of seats recently that have shifted from likely or safe red to leans Republican toss-up. So I think it's going to be an interesting election year. I think it's going to be hard for Republicans, but right now I'd give it a 50-50 chance of them holding on to the majority.
I want to bring in another caller now on the Mueller issue. Deb is with us in Vesper. Deb, hi.
Hi. I would like to say, April 23rd, the Supreme Court has a scheduled debate with Lucia versus the Securities Exchange that will determine the president's power to fire various officers, including and up to Robert Mueller. And I believe that Mitch McConnell is not allowing this vote to protect Mueller because of no laws on the books. They'll be free to do with them what they want with them.
Deb, thanks for that call. We'll be talking about the Supreme Court tomorrow with Adam Liptak, Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, and we'll bring that up with him. But, Julie, do you get a sense that Mitch McConnell didn't want to offend the president by passing a law aimed at protecting Robert Mueller?
I mean, I'm not sure if it's so much that. I think it's a touchy thing to bring up, especially in election year. It's kind of a polarizing topic. I mean, had they not received assurances that he wasn't going to be fired from the White House, I think we'd probably be looking at a different situation. Whether things change down the road and they ultimately decide to bring it up, if the White House decides to flip on that and it's looking like he's going to be removed, I think it's, we might see a different situation, but it's hard to predict. I feel like the entire Russia investigation has been almost stranger than fiction. It's an interesting area to cover.
And I wanted, before we run out of time, to bring up the passing of former First Lady Barbara Bush. She passed away last night at the age of 92. Can you talk a little bit about what people are saying around Washington about her legacy?
Both sides of the aisle have expressed their condolences and been touting her different accomplishments. And I think both parties have a lot of respect for the things she's accomplished. And I mean, overall, I think it's a loss for Washington.
Yeah, she seems like one of the few non-polarizing people I can think of, president or first lady, in a lot of years. Is that how people are talking about her?
Yeah, I'd say that's a good characterization. I saw, obviously, almost every office released a statement. And I would definitely say that it's one of the things everyone's kind of unified in is their praise of.
Well, Julie Grace, thanks a lot for joining us this week. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Julie Grace Brufke, Capitol reporter at The Hill. She joined us for a weekly look at the top national news. Again, tomorrow afternoon, we'll look at some of the cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, including big cases related to immigration and deportation. First, Racine's request to divert water from Lake Michigan for the coming Foxconn plant has been getting some pushback. It's coming from environmental advocates and some members of the public. One of the main sticking points is whether the water will be largely for public or private industrial use. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org, and he dives into that question in a new piece for the site that's out tomorrow. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, remind us about, before we get into the legal particulars, just give us the basics of this request in Racine to divert extra water and send it to Foxconn and affiliated facilities.
Right. So Racine is asking for permission to send up to 7 million gallons per day of Lake Michigan water to the Foxconn site and a nearby adjacent industrial area that'll be related to that. And that site straddles the line of the Great Lakes Basin, which is what makes it interesting and, kind of hairy from a legal and regulatory perspective.
And we've talked about the Great Lakes Compact and this before and that whole basin issue. The focus of your new piece here, and one thing that people are raising as a concern, is we're drawing water here not for public residential use. We're drawing it for a particular industrial use. And it sounds like there's a lot of gray area in the Great Lakes Compact for that.
Right. It seems like one of those things that people haven't really hashed out through the courts or through, administrative disputes or what have you. The language in the Great Lakes Compact says that you can do this if it's for public water supply purposes, and it defines public water supply purposes as being largely for residential customers with, industrial and commercial things mixed in. So the question becomes, does this really qualify as that when, the entirety of this diversion in the application, at least right now, is for the Foxconn facility and related industrial and commercial things? They're not saying in the application anywhere that it's for residences out there. Something could theoretically kind of spring up out there as it develops, of course, but that really isn't part of the equation right now, it seems.
Want to key in on that one key word here, largely. Largely residential customers. That is a vague word. There are no percentages or numbers attached to it, right?
In the compact, there's no language that puts a number on what constitutes largely residential. And the argument that Racine is making, essentially, is that even when you factor in all this industrial water use that this diversion would create, their entire service area is still largely residential. And I mean, that's true in terms of whether you're looking at it in terms of gallons or sheer number of individual customers. But the specific area they want to send water to outside the Great Lakes Basin, they're not saying there's any you know, residential component to that.
So it depends on how you slice it when you look at this. If you say, okay, Racine wants extra water, some of it's going to this new corporate thing, but as a whole, it's still mostly residential. If you say, let's look at this new request from Racine and where it's going, it's not at all residential. Is that right?
That's correct. So it's not only, it's not largely, it's no residential, but they're kind of arguing, well, there's this broader aggregate thing that, that makes it largely residential.
I want to come back to a point we've talked about before. With the Waukesha diversion, because of the technicalities, the whole Great Lakes Compact, in a way, had to weigh in on it. Because of the technicalities, the basin issue, right, the state of Wisconsin gets to make the, its own decision here.
Basically, yeah. I mean, there's a large amount of enforcing the Great Lakes Compact that is delegated to the eight Great Lakes states that that ratified this agreement. And so the situation that Racine and Foxconn are in is a bit different from the one that, that Waukesha was in. You know, Waukesha is a city that's entirely outside the Great Lakes drainage basin, which means it had to go through a whole different process, whereas something that straddles the basin line, you still have to get approval, but it's not considered quite as extraordinary, and it's reviewed on more of a state regulatory level.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about Foxconn, Racine, and a water diversion request, drawing water from Lake Michigan for the big planned new facility. One point you raised in your piece, Scott, that I thought was really interesting is, in legal terms, this is really new, and there's a lot of uncharted territory here when it comes to the Great Lakes Compact.
That's correct. I mean, you have to remember that this is something that was finalized in 2008 when, you know, Congress and then President George W. Bush kind of put their stamp of approval on it after the individual states ratified it. Obviously, it was the product of, you know, a process and a long-running debate about how do we protect this resource and maintain it, who should be allowed to access it and under what terms. But in those 10 years, there hasn't been that much of a chance to kind of really chew it over and for people to hash out how some of the specifics work. You know, it's not one of those issues where you go back and have tons and tons of case law or whatever to light the way. And that's part of the reason that Waukesha was such a big deal, because
it was
considered precedent setting, and people were very concerned that that be carried out in a way that would set what they thought were good precedents. And, you know, this, in a way, this might also be precedent setting, depending on what happens.
And you write that other states in the compact have been looking at this. They may not have say so over it, but what are you hearing from other states right now?
New York and Illinois have both chimed in, one through their attorney general's office and the other through their state level environmental regulator. And New York has specifically raised the question, I think, of how does this qualify as public water supply purposes? And they're saying right now that they haven't officially come out objecting to it, but clearly the questions sort of set the stage for how they might object to it in the future.
And Michigan, I think, had also been looking at it. I don't know if they've raised particular questions yet.
Yeah, I did talk briefly with Michigan's kind of representative to the Compact Council, a guy that Rick Snyder has kind of appointed as his proxy, and he said they were looking at it. I don't know at the moment. Forgive me, Rob. I'm not sure if they've staked out a position on it quite yet or not.
Gotcha. And now this is uncharted ground. It seems possible that someone, a citizen or another state, could in theory take this to courts and challenge this idea of largely residential use in this public utility. I won't ask you to predict how that would play in the courts, but hypothetically, somebody could try that.
Right. Under the Great Lakes Compact, if someone has a grievance with something that one of the parties to the compact is doing with Great Lakes Water, they can challenge that through sort of an administrative process that the compact sets up, you know, dealing with the representatives of each of the eight states. And if that doesn't lead to a resolution, then it can go to court. So it is, you know, it's entirely possible that if DNR approves this, and it seems likely that they will, you know, we're not really in a climate where the state is going to suddenly turn around and not give Foxconn what it's asking for. I think that'd be extraordinary at this point. And so it is likely that someone could actually kind of come and argue that this is illegal under the compact, and that it could kind of blow up into a longer dispute. I mean, obviously, I can't necessarily predict that that will happen. But if you look at kind of the conditions that are being created, they're sort of ripe for this to maybe turn into a more drawn out conflict.
In your piece in WisContext, you said some of the people who lined up in favor of the Waukesha diversion, they're also on board with Foxconn. And also consistent on the other side. But you ended your piece talking to someone who was a big supporter of the Waukesha diversion, a big opponent of the Foxconn diversion. What were some of the points he was splitting there?
Yeah, that's John Skalbeck, who is a geosciences professor at UW Parkside. And I actually saw him kind of talk in support of the Waukesha diversion at an environmental journalism conference last year. And when he finished his remarks, somebody from the Waukesha Water Utility said, like, he doesn't work with us, we swear, you know, kind of because he was so supportive that he can't. You know, but in the public comments that were submitted, he actually chimed in and said that he opposed the Foxconn water diversion specifically because of the whole public water supply purposes issue. You know, he feels that that violates the spirit of what the compact is about, to take all that water for more or less the use of one company.
And concerns here as we wrap up, just as people watched Waukesha for precedent setting, they're going to be watching Foxconn for precedent.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's also in a climate where people are really worked up about the Nestle bottled water situation in Michigan. And I think kind of all these things are combining to make people really concerned about what's happening with the Great Lakes, what kind of policy we're making about it. You know, it's a water resource that's so vast that people would have to screw up a whole lot of stuff to really meaningfully endanger it. But, you know, but there is a lot of concern about what it means when someone's allowed to send water outside of the basin at that scale for what's essentially a, you know, a big publicly traded for-profit operation.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext.org. He was with us to talk about legal issues surrounding Racine's water diversion plan for the soon-to-come Foxconn plant. You can read the story on their website tomorrow and find more reporting on Foxconn and economic development in Wisconsin at WisContext.org. People of color living outside of Wisconsin's biggest cities can encounter a lot of assumptions about why they live in a smaller community. A new exhibit of portraits is showcasing their faces and their stories in an effort to push back against common stereotypes. 20 Oshkosh residents are featured in the Color Brave photo project, Black and Brown Faces, A New Narrative. The exhibit debuts on Friday at the Payne Art Center in Oshkosh. Tracy Robertson is the executive director of FIT Oshkosh, a group working toward racial equity and justice in that community. They're presenting this project. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me.
Well, what kind of assumptions and maybe stereotypes do people have in a city like Oshkosh in the Fox Valley area when they see a person of color living in the community?
Well, a very common narrative that exists in Oshkosh specifically is if you're a black person, you have moved here because of the prison. And that is a question that I've been asked as a black citizen of the Oshkosh community repeatedly. Lots of black people that I know in the community have also been asked that question. And so one of the reasons why we are hosting this exhibit is to eliminate that stereotype, along with other stereotypes about why people might choose Oshkosh as a community to live in.
What are some of the other stereotypes you've run into?
Well, another really common narrative is that we've come from two places. We've come from either the ghettos of Milwaukee or the ghettos of Chicago. And certainly there are people who have now called Oshkosh their home that come from Milwaukee and Chicago. But there are also people of color who live here from places like Hawaii and Baltimore and Atlanta. And so we really wanted to raise up that people of color are as complex as any other group of people, and our reasons for being attracted to any community are vary. And so we wanted to be really break down that stereotype.
So you're looking to kind of interrupt this story, I guess, people might tell themselves about a minority in their own community, this instant gut reaction.
Absolutely, about where we come from, about what our experiences have been up until this point. And so that's why we're calling it shifting the narrative, because we're hoping that people will engage in this exhibit and then have new stories to tell, more positive stories about how people of color are as complex as other people.
Take us into the exhibit now. Tell us what we'll see as we go in and check it out.
Yes, so there are 20 subjects in the photo exhibit. They represent a number of underrepresented communities. So they're people, they're Black people, they're Hmong people, they're Asian people, there are Latino people involved in the photo exhibit. So there is a photo of each person, a color photo of each person, and then a story about the person in their own words, talking about what it's like to be here, what brought them here, and what's important to them as they try to build a life here in the community.
Can you tell us about a couple of the stories that don't fit that standard assumption that people might have?
Absolutely. There is one participant in the photo exhibit. His name is Elder Jenner Chandler. He is a pastor here in town, and he really came to Oshkosh believing that this is where his ministry was calling him to be. So we thought that was an important narrative to raise up. He's actually from Baltimore. He's not from the ghettos of Chicago or Milwaukee. And so his path and journey here to the community is a really unique perspective. We do have a person who identifies as a Latino who actually is a person who's been released from prison. However, he has started a really thriving barbershop here. His name is Barber Rich. He started a thriving barbershop here and has done a ton of philanthropic work in the community, has really invested in the community and turned that situation around. So while he is the person in the exhibit who does have a history that involves some time in prison, he's really become a rock star in our community and a really important figure in our community for people of all nationalities.
What did people say when you went to them and said, hey, we'd like to share your photo and your story?
They were really excited to be a part of this conversation. They all felt that it was incredibly important that we do our part to help people in our community. Our neighbors get to know us and the things that matter to us. And that, you know, we all come here because we want to be a part of this community. And we have things to contribute. We all have skills and gifts. And all of the people in the photo exhibit are doing amazing work in the community. So people felt really honored to be asked to be a part of it and really stepped up and wanted to get involved.
Talking to Tracy Robertson, Executive Director of FIT Oshkosh, a group working toward racial equity and justice in that community. We're looking at this a photo and story project, Black and Brown Faces, a New Narrative, sharing stories that might break assumptions about people of color living in the Fox Valley. Can you talk a little bit, Tracy, about the photos themselves? Are these things we might see in any sort of artistic photo exhibit?
I think one thing that really sets this photo exhibit apart is that we were really intentional about getting a person of color to be the photographer. And so we identified a photographer. She's exceptional. Her name is Colleen Beast. She is a Hmong American resident of Oshkosh. She's been here since she was a young girl. And so she's the photographer on the project. And her perspective from her artistic perspective, I think, is very unique. And the photos are not photos where people were posed. She spent a lot of time talking to, kind of interviewing the people as she took photos of them. So you see them in very natural poses, kind of in a conversational sort of life. So the photos have been incredibly impactful. And for me, every time I see them, they're very emotional.
This is called the Color Brave Photo Project. That phrase, Color Brave, is part of your mission at FIT Oshkosh. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So we talk about color bravery. I don't know, Melody Hobson is the president of Aerial Management in Chicago, Illinois. She's also married to George Lucas of Star Wars fame. She has a very powerful TED Talk that talks about being colorblind, color brave. And so it has really become the catalyst for the work that we do. And so we talk about being color brave because what we've been taught, particularly in the Midwest, is that the answer is to be colorblind, to pretend like we don't see race. And we know that that's not true. We know that when people of color walk into a room, you immediately assign some kind of racial identity to them, whether that's consciously or subconsciously. So our hope is that people will move away from that color brave ideal, which we know doesn't work. I mean, we can look at race relations in our country and know that pretending like we don't see race is not the answer, to really moving to a place of being color brave, where I acknowledge that race exists, I recognize that the people who identify in underrepresented communities have a story to tell, have experiences that are unique to them. So we're asking people to stop saying that they're colorblind and really move into some practices, get some tools, do some education that would afford them an opportunity to be more brave around their engagement when they think about race and race equity.
It sounds like it might take some courage. I think a lot of people are reluctant to talk about race, whether they want to or not. Is that part of the brave part of it, an act of courage to tackle these issues?
Well, what we tell people in the workshops that we do at Fit Oshkosh is that we're not asking you to be competent. We're asking you to be brave. And so bravery means I'm going to step out. I'm going to ask appropriate questions. I'm going to do my own education. I'm not going to make the one person of color in my space my cultural attaché. But I'm really going to read blogs and read books and look at, YouTube videos and all those things that will help me to understand, you know, race from my lens, and then use those tools as you're learning them to go out and have brave engagement. And that means that sometimes you will not say the right things, and when you're in your color brave work, when that happens, your response is to be, yep, I messed up, let me step back and do that again, right? So it's like learning anything. It's like learning to ride a bike. It's like learning to any new skill. You're going to trip and fall, and what we're asking you to do is stand up, brush yourself off, revisit what you the engagement you had, and then come back to the table with a different approach.
The photo project is going to be on display, as we mentioned, from the 20th to the 22nd at the Payne Arts Center there in Oshkosh, but then it's going to hit the road. Can you talk about the tour?
It is. It's going to go to the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. Reunion, it'll be there April 30th through May 4th. Then it's going to go to First Congregational Church here in Oshkosh. It'll be there from May 5th through May 9th. It's going to go to The Draw in Appleton, which is a space for photographers and people who do, it's kind of an incubator for artists. It'll be there May 31st through June 9th. Then it's going to go to Marion University in Fond du Lac from September 17th through September 20th, and it's going to spend its remaining days at the Appleton Public Library from September 27th through October 3rd. And people can check out the Fit Oshkosh website at fitoshkoshinc.org for a complete schedule of the exhibit.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Tracy, what do you hope people walk out of the exhibit thinking about?
I really hope, we're all about action at Fit Oshkosh, and so I really hope that people will walk away with these stories and share them in their networks and understand that they not only have an opportunity, but they have it's going to be important that they talk about what they've learned and help us shift this narrative. We want to create a more positive narrative in our community so that we can retain and attract not only people of color, but young white people who really want to live in places that they perceive as diverse. So our goal is to have people go through this experience and walk away owning that they have a part to play.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Tracy Robertson, Executive Director at Fit Oshkosh, the group presenting the Color Brave Photo Project. It will come up on display this weekend at the Payne Arts Center in Oshkosh and then make the rounds, as we just heard, in the Fox Cities after that. Vel Phillips passed away yesterday at the age of 94. She was a legendary activist and elected official here in Wisconsin. Her list of firsts, as we've heard in the news, just keeps going on. First African-American woman to graduate from the UW Law School, first female and first African-American on the Milwaukee Common Council, first female judge in Milwaukee County, first female and first African-American woman to be elected to statewide office in Wisconsin. You can learn more about her career and influence. There's an article online at WPR.org in our news section. We'll play a feature later here on Central Time. And you can also join the morning show from 7 to 8 tomorrow. Phillips joined us on Central Time back in 2014. She made the case for more people getting involved in politics and political activism, even if they didn't see themselves as being the kinds of people who got involved.
If you know that what you want to do is to make a better city or state or United States and to right some of the wrongs, then you should hang in there and do it and not be swayed by the fact that it hasn't been done before.
the voice of Val Phillips here on Central Time back in 2014. This is the Ideas Network.